this week in the Inside Flap.
And there was a billboard that people had posted all these notes on, trying to find children, trying to find, you know, their families. And there was even a notice that said on it, death notices may be posted here, you know, And so I had to put that detail in there because it really happened, and it brings the humanity to this event. You know, when you have a billboard that was a day before advertising beer is now advertising missing people and sometimes people who have perished.
So I go back down to my classroom, the big band room, and now the setup now, of course, because I got one computer with my virtual kids in front of me. I've got my three virtual, I've got my three live students in front of me. Now I've got this math teacher, I've got another computer with her virtual students on that computer, and then I've got her four live students in front of me as well. So I've got two computers, two sets of live kids in front of me, and I'm going back and forth. I don't know who to talk to.
The Inside Flap is available on demand every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com.
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Seated across the room, in bed, is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
And 2 hours up the road from Granby, Colorado, is Andrew Dowd. Andrew.
Excelsior.
What's happening? Thank you guys so much for joining us. Welcome to
The Inside Flap
Book Podcast. We've got book recommendations for you tonight, today, whenever the hell you're listening to us. We've got
Audiobook of the Week.
And USA Today bestselling author Susan Meisner is here. Laura and I had a fantastic conversation with her just yesterday, and we'll have that for you in just a little bit. We'll sponsor today by IndieBound. Make sure you're getting your books from independent booksellers everywhere, and you could do that by checking out the IndieBound website to get there. We would appreciate it if you would go to our website first, theinsideflap.com, click over the IndieBound link, and support not only independent booksellers, but also our show. And it won't cost you a penny extra. All right. And let's see here. What do we got going on? I know I got on here the other week, and I talked to you guys, Andrew and Laura. I talked to you guys why it is the first thing I did as soon as I got into my new room, as soon as we got back to school, and I got into the big band room, the first thing I did was to unplug my phone.
That's right.
Do you recall why I said to do that?
Yeah, because they'll call you and ask you to cover a class.
That's right, because we got all kinds of...
we listen to you, Dave.
...teachers out of the building, not only because they're calling in sick left and right, but also because they have decided, for whatever reason, they don't feel safe. They're not coming back. They're teaching from home. We got maybe one-fourth of our staff is teaching from home. Yes, every day. And they got a waiver from the district or whatever.
But that's not an unexpected thing. You already knew. They already knew 25% of their staff wasn't coming back, right?
Right. But the point is this. The point is, more than ever, we need more coverage. And more than ever, I didn't like doing it, because what you have to do is you have to give up
your break
in order to cover a class. Well.
Do you get paid extra if you cover?
Yes, you do.
Oh.
Don't read ahead. Now.
Oh.
You get $24 and some odd cents for covering a class.
That's it?
What did you expect? This
That's
is
what you
education.
Get. Forget it. I'm taking a break.
Well,
you have got to be kidding me.
No, I'm not kidding you.
U.S. dollars or Canadian dollars?
And not only that, but the secretary always, when she sends out the email...
Pesos, Andrew, pesos.
When she sends out the email every morning saying what classes need coverage, and there's always multiple classes, multiple teachers need coverage, she always puts and she highlights it in yellow, reminder, you get paid $24.38 or whatever.
That's making it worse.
To do it. Well, these are teachers we're talking about. Now, so here's what happened this morning.
I guess if you cover two classes, then you get $50. The problem is, it's taxed, whatever. Yeah. Whatever.
Well, whatever. So this morning,
how much does that equal out to an hour?
Well, a class lasts 45 minutes, so
I'm picturing a longer class. Okay.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is, I think the pay is the same no matter how long the class is, which is kind of strange.
Oh.
But anyway.
$32 an hour.
Oh, okay. There.
Thanks, Andrew.
Quick math.
That was really quick.
Andrew.
God, that's
Well, I noticed his camera went away, so I think he did it on his phone.
Good. I know, yeah. But still.
Still.
Didn't even occur to me to do math.
Kudos. Well done. So this morning I get into school and I went down to the main office because I wanted to chat with our principal as he and I had a guy we used to work with sadly passed away recently. So I wanted to chat with him about that. One interesting thing that came out of that conversation is that I was like, hey, did you hear about so-and-so? I'm like, man, yeah, he was such a positive guy. I really liked being around him. Such a great influence. And he goes, his first reaction to me was, quite contentious.
Oh.
That was his.
About a dead man.
Yeah, about a guy who just sadly passed away. Quite content. Still working, by the way. Unfortunately, he was 1 year away from retirement. But went in for surgery and did not make it out of surgery.
Whoa.
But that was my principal's reaction. Quite contentious.
Huh.
So we're having that awkward conversation, and it's right outside the main office. And then all of a sudden...
I wonder what type of surgery this was.
I don't know. Hmm. I do know the guy was suffering from prostate cancer for years, so I'm sure it was complications from prostate cancer.
That makes me feel a little bit better. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just dental surgery.
So there was something going on.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm standing out there by the office, and I got my Apple Watch on, and all of a sudden I start feeling little vibrations on the old wrist going on.
What a terrible noise!
Now I'm talking to my principal, so I don't want to look. You know, I feel like it'll be rude if I look down. All right, let me stop that. And that's my watch. It just kept going on and on and on. And I don't want to look down at it like, hey, nice chatting with you, but oh, look at the time.
He can't hear it, right?
No, he can't hear it. Okay. No, but I can certainly feel it. This is the the equivalent of the noise as it's attacking my wrist, like a toddler clomping on with their jaw. So that's going on, and I'm trying to ignore it. I'm trying to hear what he's telling me about. Whatever. Oh, I know. You know what he said? He told me that he has reached the age where he just doesn't give a shit about what people think about him. we were having a nice little chat. Anyway, the watch is going on.
Yeah, well, that goes in with his saying that guy was contentious.
Yeah.
What age is that?
Yeah.
In his 60s. And then he told me, well, you know, and as he's laughing about the guy who sadly passed away, well, he didn't laugh about it, but, you know, chit-chatting
about
it. He's smiling. You know, Dave, you make a lot of connections in this business. You know a lot of people. And, you know, let's face it, I'm at the age where people start dying.
Oh.
I'm like, okay, so you're not going to get too upset about it. That's one way to look at it.
I don't know. Is 65 retirement right now?
It all depends on how many years you have in as a teacher, what your para is like.
That seems young to die.
He told me his wife, she started at the age of 20 and she retired at the age of 50.
Wow. Yeah.
He's in his 60s and he said he's got 2 more years to put in.
I feel like I'm going to work until I drop.
Yeah, I'll be 95.
Yeah.
Now, especially since I cashed in that retirement fund from New York and we didn't start out here in Denver until 2004. So, yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, we'll be
good. And you're not taking those $24.
Well, hold on. Hold on just a second. So my watch is going off, and I say goodbye to the principal. I start walking down the hallway, I look at my watch. Who it is? It's the secretary, Ruby. Ruby has found another way to hunt me down. She has texted me on my watch. She says,
"That's
listen,
so funny."
This math teacher is out.
Oh, she's on to you now.
She says, "Please, please, please." And this is why I don't like the phones, because it's hard to say no.
Oh,
to
it's
someone,
impossible.
Right?
When,
it's hard
when
to
you
say
talk
no.
to somebody. Easy, or if you're face to face, it's
right,
so hard.
Easy to ignore, hard to say no.
So hard.
And I know she's got a really tough job. She's got to find somebody to cover for this, and it's a pain in the butt. So she texts, "Can you cover this math teacher's homeroom class?" I text back, "No problem. Absolutely not. I'll get on the Google Meet, whatever. Send me all the info. I'll take care of it."
Okay.
So I go back down to my classroom, the big band room, and now the setup. Now of course, because I've got one computer with my virtual kids in front of me. I've got my three virtual. I've got my three live students in front of me. Now I've got this math teacher. I've got another computer with her virtual students on that computer, and then I've got her four live students in front of me as well. So I've got two computers, two sets of live kids in front of me, and I'm going back and forth. I don't know who to talk to. I got ninth graders, 10th graders, the lesson, the presentation I'm supposed to show. I'm trying to put it on both computers. It's crazy.
So Dave, this is where that split personality comes in real handy.
Well, it's really funny is that a girl asked me if if they make a sequel to the movie Split, that I need to be in it because of the way I act in class. So you can take that for what you will. But anyway, what ended up happening is I scrapped the presentations and talked to Khadijah about Game of Thrones because she's watching Game of Thrones. So we had a great talk about that as everybody just stared at us. Anyway. So then, all of a sudden, I'm in the middle of class, and what happens again? This is in the middle of the homeroom class. The old cell phone or the old watch starts going again. Uh-huh. And I look, and it's Ruby. And now Ruby's saying, listen, I can't get anyone to cover it in the other math teachers' classes.
Whoa.
Can you do either second period, sixth period, or seventh period? And at this point, I'm just like, you know what? Forget it. Send them all in. Let's go. Let me make it $100 day. Send them all in.
Wow.
I'll take them all. And it turned out great.
Really?
I had to do, I got the Google Meet. So the very first 2 minutes of class, I set up the computer. I logged in the Google Meet. I put the document from the teacher in the chat. The kids can click on that.
Oh.
I said, here you go, kids. If you have any questions, put it in the chat. I'll monitor it during class. And I went about my day. I had that little computer tucked away to the side. Every once in a while, I look over there. I had her live students, two or three extra kids in class.
Huh.
I chatted with them. It was great. It was great.
And you made $100.
Four classes at $24 a pop. Nearly $100.
Nice job, Dave Medicus.
Yeah, so there you go. So that's going to be my
new
thing.
You're
going to
retire early.
Anytime that wrist goes off, you know what I'm going to do? I might go in tomorrow morning and tell Ruby, you know what? Send them my way. I'm ready for them. Look at me. I can do it. Who knew that you don't have to take off a free period to what? Now you don't have to. It's so easy peasy. Set up a computer in the corner of the room. Good to go.
That's interesting.
So I'm going to be taking them all on. So that's my new plan.
That's your new side hustle.
Yep. That's
My
little side hustle. We'll see how much extra.
Your gig economy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Laura, how's everything going by you?
Oh, good. I had a dentist appointment recently. So.
Yes, you did.
Dentist, it's so annoying now because nowadays you're supposed to get your teeth cleaned 6 months, every 6 months.
This is what it sounded like the last time I was at the dentist. I think my guy was a little overzealous with the chainsaw.
Just a little. I feel like one of us in this family is always preparing to go to the dentist because it's every 6 months and it just comes right up.
Mm-hmm.
And then like there's another person in the family. Probably you have the same thing, Andrew, with your kids since there's five of you.
Yeah.
It's just a constant, unless you guys knock it all out in one visit, that might be the way to go.
Well, and it's, you know, and where we live is great. And Katie is great, but what we've actually found is we found a children's dentist that can take all three of our kids at once.
See, that's the way to do it.
Yeah, a children's eye doctor that can take all three kids at once.
Yeah, otherwise you're constantly bringing them in because it's a constant thing nowadays.
Yeah, and what he didn't tell you, they're all in the same room at the same time. So the dentist it's like goes from one mouth to the next.
That would be cute.
You know, keep it all in the family like that.
Yeah, but we live very close to our dentist, so I can walk to the dentist. She is...
Two blocks away.
Yeah, two blocks away.
Literally two blocks away.
So I honestly would feel ashamed of myself if I drove those two blocks. Yes. So I walked... the first time, and this was fairly recently. And
I do have audio of you walking to the dentist.
Do you?
Yes, I do. Yeah, right here.
Okay.
It's a wide street with lots of big...
I just slowly plodded up the street.
Big walls on the side. Echoes a lot. Very echoey street.
Yeah. That's funny. Uh-huh. And it was really cold outside, but I walked anyway because I just feel like, I don't know, the two blocks that it would take me would, my car wouldn't even warm up by the time it's, I get those two
and
blocks.
Also it's longer to walk to the garage, open the garage door, pull out of the garage, and the garage is in the opposite direction, and then you might hit a stop sign or two, you might hit a person or two, you know,
and they check temperature at this dentist, and so she checks my temperature, and she's like, whoa, it's too low, it's not registering. And I said, well, I walked here.
Oh, okay.
And she goes, you walked here? And I said, yeah. And it wasn't.
Was it like that? Was that her reaction?
Yes, it was.
What?
Yes. And well, she's like, well, why don't you go wash your hands, wash up, which is what they have you do, and then come back and I'll recheck your temperature. She was like focused on like getting my temperature normal, even though like
can the outdoor weather affect your temperature?
Yes, because it's a temporal. That's how they
do
it on your
reading the forehead. Well,
yeah. Go ahead, Andrew.
But the thing is, if you don't have a fever,
that was my point.
What does it freaking matter?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't. But this woman was so puzzled that I didn't register that I was so cold or below. So I come out check it again.
This patient is cold.
It's still not reading. And I said, well, it's cold outside. And she's like, okay, well, let's get you into a chair. And then a third time she came back to me again and checked. And she's like, oh, okay, it's very low. It's 97 blah, 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 or whatever it was.
Now, she never came at you with the paddles. You never saw her.
No, like, I didn't see her with the paddles.
Some paddles. That's when you got to run in the opposite
direction. No, but she was puzzled as to why I would walk. And so I was like, well, I only live, I live two blocks away from you guys. Oh,
you
okay.
Tell her, so it's ever since I woke up with those two puncture wounds on my neck.
The blood has been so cold.
I haven't been able to see my reflection either. I don't know what that's about. So I had a cavity, right? So I had to come back.
Mm.
So I walked again the next 2 weeks later. I walked again. It was not as cold. My temperature was fine. But there was something with how it was. I think it was a little warm. And I was like, oh, it's okay. I walked here. And because they were like, oh, you can wait in your car. So, well, I'll wait outside. I walked here.
I don't have a car. Yeah.
And it caused, again, a different person. But such a kerfuffle. And a strange, like, oh, wow, you walked here. How far away do you live?
Are you bionic? What's
and I was like, well, I only live like 2.5 blocks away. But they still couldn't fathom. And I don't know if it's because we live in the burbs. It has to be. Like, why wouldn't
I walk? The idea of you
but
walking
it,
two
it
blocks.
It sparked conversation between my hygienist and the doc. And all other kinds of people. And then I was also told, like, wow, you're going to get your exercise. And I'm thinking, not really. It's two blocks.
Not even getting warmed up.
Yeah. I'm not even going half a mile.
You need a snack?
Ladies.
Lay down. Take a load off. Can I get you an apple? How about a granola bar?
It was so strange, though, because...
She's healthy. She walked.
I know. They thought that about me, and I'm not that healthy.
How did she get a cavity? She's healthy.
I know. Well, yeah. I know. I did, like, that. I got that weird... It was the kind of attention, though, where I started to feel uncomfortable because I started to feel like, I don't
know.
We
got a walker over here. Look at this.
Like somebody who's done something so weird that it's wrong or odd. And then I just also started wondering, like, God, as a society, we got to start building our city. I mean, it's too late now, probably, but I mean, we live
our culture.
Yeah, but at least we live in Littleton. You live in an area where you can walk to stuff. That's why we live here. Yeah, so why
we walk to the 7-Eleven all the time.
We do.
Two blocks away. And get a Slurpee.
Schlep back. We walk to the Starbucks.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Thrift store. Where else do we walk to?
Reminds me of a story.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Germany as a young lad, so I was in my early 20s. And I was with 50 other Americans.
Wow.
And so we were on a tour bus touring Berlin, Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And the tour guide did not have the best opinion of Americans, let me tell you.
Oh, I bet.
And so at one point she pulls up, well, there's this building, but in order to get to the top, there's 200 stairs there. So that's nothing for you Americans to walk up. And it just kept going the whole time. And we were like, everybody was tuned into what she was saying because what she was saying was just so
yes,
you know,
awful.
Anti-American.
Yeah, so awful.
And, you know, you think we'd all weigh 300 pounds on the bus or something.
I know.
But it was just like, you know, we really got a kick out of it in the end because, like, she'd say something, we're all just like, ho, ho. But, you know, Laura, your story, only in America.
Right?
Honestly. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Would somebody wonder about, you know, walking a couple blocks?
I know. And
you
also,
you want to take your shoes off? Do you need to relax?
Dave and I lived in New York City, and I mean, I would regularly walk
everywhere.
A lot just because sometimes the subway didn't run there you'd miss a bus or something.
We certainly did not own a car.
And it would be weird to have even caught a cab for those two blocks. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, but here... It was seen as strange. It's almost like you always hear that about LA, but I think LA, you know, no one walks in LA. I think it's probably a similar thing all over our country.
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, we are the country who gave the rest of the world McDonald's and
fast food.
Hmm.
How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm doing good. I'm up. Me and Rex are up here in Granby. So, you know, it was like -5 this morning when I woke up.
Oh, man.
Oh, you got up last night.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I will share with you a story. So Dashiell wanted, for Christmas, he wanted what's called a mono wheel. Now, a mono wheel is like this big
I've
wheel.
Oh, I've seen those. They're really trendy right now.
Yeah, with like a board on it.
Mm-hmm. Now, oh, it got the, okay. So it's not a
And
a
it's got lights and stuff, right? Kind of lights up a little bit.
Yeah, it's like one big wheel, and it has a, you know, almost like a small car tire.
Yeah.
With like a little board on it.
It's like a skateboard, except it's got the big car tire, basically, right in the middle of it.
Yep.
And you can you straddle this wheel as it goes.
It's like a little motorized, isn't it, though?
Is it motorized?
Yes, electric.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I looked it up, you know, and the thing is, these things are dangerous, you know? I mean, because basically, you fall off of this thing, and you're doing a Superman, flying through the air, because there's nothing to hold on to. There's nothing to catch. You know, so I researched this, and of course, OPD, that's overprotective dad.
Sure.
That's you, yep.
Oh, you know me. It's OPD.
It's OPD. And so anyways, I find one that's a mono wheel with a handlebar, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah, a little safer, sounds safer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. And so basically, I got it for Dashiell for Christmas, and he hated the thing, right? I mean, he's like, that's not what I wanted.
Yeah.
I wanted a mono wheel. I'm like, look, it's got one wheel. It's a mono wheel. Right?
Merry Christmas, kid.
Bless his heart.
Yeah, it's got a, you know.
I'm
so
feeling
anyways,
sorry for Dashiell.
So he finally gets used to it, and he likes it.
Okay.
All right.
Right? But, of course, this weekend we had a little incident, and he was riding this thing. You know, and it'll go like 12 miles an hour. But of course, he hits something.
Right.
And the next thing you know, he is doing a Superman.
Oh, wow. No.
And so he lands on both arms.
Wow.
And I don't know how he's not more damaged than he is, but he basically sprained both wrists.
Whoa.
You know? And,
oh, no.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where it's like, do we take him to get x-rays? Do we not take him to get x-rays, and he can move his fingers and things like that. And I look at his arms, and they look a little bit bent. But
oh, my gosh. Was he?
But, you know, the consensus is, well, if you can move his fingers.
Yeah, rub some dirt in there, spit on it. Yeah, that's what we did as kids. Yeah,
they're probably not broken.
Was he close to home?
But,
did anyone see him fall?
Right in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
I mean, he wouldn't be riding this thing anywhere, anywhere further than that. But, you know, it's just one of those things as a parent, it's like, you know, I knew the damn thing was dangerous. I knew it wasn't a good idea. And then the kid, completely oblivious as to the danger of this thing, you know, but now, of course, reality.
He's not going to want to get back on. Has he been back on that thing since then?
When I asked him, I said, are you done with it? He's like, I don't know yet, Dad.
Let him heal.
So last night, he slept with Katie last night because, you know, he's got the bed propped up and everything. So I talked to Katie this morning, and he's got like a brace on his wrist and stuff. And she's like, man, that kid was tossing and turning. He whacked me in the face with
his
brace
his
in the middle of the night.
Oh,
man.
You know, so it's, you know, anybody who is a parent, realizes that, you know, sleepless nights are not just for when you have infants.
No, kids. They like Sylvia, when we would have to sleep with her or take turns because she had nightmares. I mean, it's like waking up and almost punching you in the face is what she would do in her sleep. Kicking. I mean, it's nuts. Nuts what kids do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so it's the worst, actually.
Put that thing back in storage. Oh. Stick it up in the attic.
I'm glad he's okay. Sounds like he's sore, though.
You know, Dave, I'd like to ask George and Mary when the sleepless night stopped for them.
Now, David
has not stopped yet. All right. Now, moving on. We got a special guest today. Our guest this week is Susan Meissner. She's got a new book out. It is fantastic. It is called The Nature of Fragile Things, about the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, among other things. We talk about that with Susan, and we'll tell you a little bit more about that book in just a second. But first, here we go with the delightful Susan Meissner. It's the
your wall of fame.
Yes.
Oh, that's nice.
Thanks. It was a quandary what to do with all those posters. And I thought, well, I've got this blank wall, and now that you're zooming everywhere, I thought, well, it's nice to have a little backdrop.
It's really good. That's it.
Thanks.
We both loved your latest novel, The Nature of Fragile Things, a story set in 1906, San Francisco, before, during, and after that massive earthquake. I love this book. I started reading it at night, which was a mistake, and I just kept reading. It was so good. I was telling my daughter about it the next day when I was driving her to school. What inspired you to write this?
Oh, thank you. Actually, thank you very much for that compliment. I appreciate that very much. Well, I live in California. It's my home state, and this is not my first book, so I've written others, and they've always been settled in other places. I've written, you know, Philadelphia and Europe and Texas and New York. And I thought, you know, there's probably stories just waiting to be told right here where I'm from. And so I just started thinking, well, what stories would I want to tell from my home state that haven't really had a whole lot of light shown on them already? And I didn't know of very many novels written about the 1906 earthquake. And it's a pretty definitive moment for San Francisco. Yeah. And I thought, well, I think I'll start with that. And then, of course, I did the research dive to see what I could do with a setting where the whole world seems to be crumbling beneath you. And so what I set out to do then was tell a story about a person, not so much a quake or a disaster or even a bunch of people that survived, but just one person. And what if for her, her life begins to unravel hours before the quake, so that when the quake happens, everything about her world is crumbling beneath her feet.
Yeah.
What a story. I mean, it hooked me at the very beginning. Yeah. You have two chapters. You start with a police interview of Sophie, your star. And that's immediately you're like, oh, what's going on here? Something is different. And then you have her traveling to meet this man to marry that she'd never met. Your first two chapters, I feel like, could be taught in the class of like how to hook a reader.
Yes.
Are those chapters for you? Is that something that you like work on? I'm assuming you know that gotta hook us with that thing.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those, I guess, writing a novel 101 things that you learn at the get-go, which you got to bring your reader in right away because there's so many other choices out there. And so a book that doesn't start to invite like their interest in a huge way from the very beginning, they can always put that book down and you don't want that. So I do look for a way to try and hook my reader in a nice way. And I'm not trying to manipulate anybody into reading, but I really want you to, come along on a ride with me. Like I'm preparing you for a great ride. Yeah. Let's buckle up and have some fun. And so, you know, I thought, well, if I start out with just this woman, she's a mail order bride. Really, she's chosen to marry this man from San Francisco. She's from New York, living in a terrible tenement. She's an immigrant with not a lot of money. So she's desperate to get out, decides to marry this man she does not know, comes west to San Francisco. And I thought, well, if I just start with that, that's okay. But what if we start, like after the earthquake, and we know she's married this man, but it's 7 months past the earthquake and he's missing. Mm-hmm. Well, I thought, I'd want to know, well, what happened between the time she was on the ferry coming to meet him and 7 months after this catastrophic earthquake when he's not around? Like, well, somebody knows where he is.
Yeah.
You know, where is he? And so I thought, well, if that interests me, hopefully it'll interest a reader.
Yeah. Yeah. And then she, it's weird. I found it so plausible that she would marry this guy. I think because you described this tenement and I thought, oh, sure.
Yeah.
I'd want to do that too. I wouldn't blame her. And having this like child right away seems great. It just seemed very plausible to me, that she would do that. Was this something that was done back then that, people would do like put out advertisements and stuff like that?
Actually, it was pretty common, especially men looking for wives who were in the West. So if you're part of the westward expansion, and even into the turn of the century where the West is still being built up, there were far more men than women. So like a lot of men came out West to like seek their fortune, buy land. You know, it was a whole new horizon to go West. And a lot of people made their, you know, their money either in the railroad or in the gold rush. Mm-hmm. But like in the 1850s and 1860s in the West, there was like 100 men to every one woman. And so
smelled then, very smelly, so, a very smelly time. Yeah, back
the
then.
Odds,
yeah.
The odds weren't in your favor if you were a gentleman.
Yeah.
And so for a lot of these fellows, you know, it wasn't so much that they wanted a relationship like we see now with eHarmony and Match.com. They really wanted a wife. Children, all the things that make a normal family, they didn't have those things. And so, and where are you going to find somebody to marry if there's nobody around? And so you have a lot of men putting personal ads, and there was no agency watching over any of this. So anybody could put an ad in any newspaper. And then you had women in the East, a lot of them who felt like, well, I'm 24 and I'm not married, and they're feeling like they're destined for spinsterhood. And if they've got, I know, right? And if they got a little bit of courage and a little bit of adventuresome spirit, they could see an ad like that, especially when, you know, it's like, you know, this man who's like advertising is in San Francisco, which was called the Paris of the West. And she's living in a hovel in New York, and she's alone and young and penniless. She's probably not looking for love either, you know. A person like that is also looking for stability, security, family, children, companion. And then they hope, you know, think everyone would hope, well, let's hope that affection will grow. But that's not the reason they go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you describe, it's the Paris of the West. I mean, you describe electric lights before the earthquake, of course, indoor plumbing, cable cars, you know, hot and cold taps. It sounded gorgeous. And I know there's like a female architect that was in San Francisco around that time, Julia somebody, but they're all like, I remember reading and seeing architecture books. It was a beautiful city. Did you look at images of the city, I'm assuming, before the earthquake?
Yes. There are actually quite a few photographs of San Francisco before the quake. Mm-hmm. And it really was a beautiful city. Lots of tall buildings, tall for then.
Yeah.
Like the tallest building on the West Coast was in San Francisco at the time. Lots of beautiful hotels. Mm-hmm. And there were some nefarious neighborhoods, too. It wasn't all roses. But, you know, for the most part, it was a very wealthy city. Many, many millionaires lived there. Beautiful houses, really beautiful Victorian houses. And then the people had made money. If you'd come out West to, like, build a business, it was great. People made money in the gold rush. People made money in the railroad. People made money in shipping. So it was a place to where you could excel. And a lot of people did. So it was a pretty beautiful city with a lot going for it.
Yeah.
And then you describe the earthquake, the cataclysmic earthquake that shook the city to its core. So I gotta know, you live out there in California. Of course, you're in San Diego. I don't know where the fault line runs. But when you're writing something like this, does it make you more a little hypersensitive to maybe your state being cleaved off from the rest of the continent?
Oh, my goodness, yes. You know, before I did the research dive, I really didn't know what was underneath California. Well, now I know, and it is a little bit chilling, because the thing is California, the whole state, sits on a boundary line of two tectonic plates. So the rest of the United States is on the North American plate.
Right.
And California straddles the North American plate and the Pacific plate. And the San Andreas Fault, which runs through California north to south, it's a pretty famous fault.
Right.
Well, San Diego, where I am, is like right to the left of it. So we're on the ocean side.
Oh, you know,
we're on the Pacific plate.
Yeah.
And so if there ever was a cataclysmic quake where I live, the joke that San Diego would fall into the ocean, I don't know if it's possible, but the coastline would change because of where we sit on this gigantic tectonic plate.
Mm.
And they're moving all the time. It's when they touch that there's a problem, and that's what happened in San Francisco on, you know, April 18, 1906.
Yeah.
Is that the Pacific plate and the North American plate had a little kiss, and it was bad. It was bad. And so, you know, we're talking 7.9 on a Richter scale. If there had been a Richter scale then, it was massive. And so I appreciate now the power of an earthquake more than I did before. But, you know, the thing about living here is you can't live in fear. You just can't.
No.
You just can't. And there's no way to predict when an earthquake will come. It's not like a hurricane or a tornado. There's no Doppler that can tell you, here comes one. They can be measured with a lot of accuracy, actually, but they can't be predicted. But I'm not going to, I can't fear that, you know. And actually, we haven't had a big one in Southern California, where I am, in a long time. There was one in L.A. in 1994 that was pretty significant.
Right.
There was one in 1989 in the Bay Area.
The World Series.
But where I am, it's been pretty quiet.
Okay. All right. Well, knock on wood. We'll keep that.
Yeah, right.
Or you could end up with waterfront property. I don't know. I don't know.
I know. Right? Depending on how far inland you are.
But you described this earthquake horrifically. You did a great job describing it and the aftermath of it. And I was reminded, it took me back to when we were living in New York in the days following 9/11, and you would see these messages posted up, these notes like, have you seen, and these community bulletin boards, and you describe that same thing in this book. Are there like historical records of these post-it notes, or were you just drawing on your
Yeah, in fact, the scene that I include in the book, where my main character has been evacuated to Golden Gate Park, where a great many people who lived in downtown evacuated to escape this raging inferno that the quake created,
and the fire,
because of broken gas lines and broken water mains. And so they're running from this fire. They're going to Golden Gate Park, and she gets there, and it's just a mass of humanity, refugees trying to escape the fire. Mm-hmm. And there was a billboard that people had posted all these notes on, trying to find children, trying to find, you know, their families. And there was even a notice that said on it, death notices may be posted here, you know,
which,
and so I had to put that detail in there because it really happened. And it brings the humanity to this event. You know, when you have a billboard that was a day before advertising beer is now advertising missing people and sometimes people who have perished.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It does bring it home.
Mm-hmm. Those scenes were so realistic. Mm-hmm. Like I really could feel myself there. It's very well. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And just your details, like the details of the, and what you don't even think about are these horses, and they're sickly and they're skinny because they're being worked to death. Just little details like that really bring it home. But speaking of details, you have a main character who's this Irish woman, and I'm curious, as you write, and you don't write in the dialect, you throw a tiz in there every once in a while, but I'm curious to know, as you're writing her, do you try out a little Irish accent as you're talking? Do you do any of that?
I'm not good at my Irish accent. I would try to think in that, but yeah. I'm not good at it. I just know what a good one sounds like.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with having imagined all of her dialogue in my own voice. I'm okay with that because I know that when we picked our audio book narrator, we were going to go with somebody who was a native speaker.
Oh,
and so, and we have, and she's amazing. And so I know that now the audio version of Sophie's story will be told by somebody who totally can speak the language and the dialect and have it sound like it's the real deal. But yes, she's from Ireland because that's where a lot of my, actually both maternal and paternal ancestors came from. They came from both Ireland, England, and Germany. And so, and I wanted to pick a place that it was at least part of my own heritage. And so I chose that one.
Huh. Well, that's great because there's a, you know, that huge Irish immigrant experience going. So it works for two mm-hmm. levels for you. And I can't wait to listen to that. I'm a big audiobook fan. So
right?
Now I'm going to have
yeah.
to. That is awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, she's amazing.
That's great. That's really smart to get somebody. You would have to get, I mean, she's the your main voice for the book. So why would
yeah.
you not get somebody?
It was, for this one, it was kind of a no-brainer that we had to get somebody who either sounded really convincing or was a native speaker. And this yeah. narrator was, she was born there and doesn't live there now, but it's part of her. It's part of the fabric of her voice, you know, is having grown up there. Yeah.
You know, and then you talk about the earthquake, going back to the earthquake for a second, something else you don't think about and you describe in the book is the looting that goes. I didn't even think about mm-hmm. that, but yeah, a tremendous amount of looting. I would guess that these buildings are just crumbled and just what a scene it must have been. How, mm-hmm. I mean, how long did that go on for?
Well, in the initial days, like when everything was just chaos and the National Guard had been called in, but they hadn't like been able to fan out and create order because it was just chaos. So in the beginning, it was a little crazy. And there was a notice put out by the police, the local governing bodies, that if you're found looting, you will be shot. And that was like that was broadcast everywhere in any way they could. If you're found looting, you'll be shot.
Wow.
And apparently there was one man on the record books. There was one man who was shot in the street mm-hmm. for looting. I don't think there were any more than that. Maybe it was they decided to come through on the promise as a deterrent to others because he was shot. And that was hopefully a deterrent to others. So in the days and plus, too, during the worst of it, when there wasn't law and order around, the fire was intense. And so nobody could really stay where the fire was because it was just an inferno.
Right.
And so the looting again would again happen after the fire. And by then, you know, the army had been brought in and the National Guard had been brought in. And it was easier to have some form of law and order. And it still happened. In fact, there were people coming over on the ferry. This is after the fire when the ash had settled and we were starting to recover now. People would come over on the ferry and they would pick through the debris to get souvenirs. They would look debris for souvenirs of the quake. So,
wow.
And then someone sell it. Someone set up little kiosks and sell souvenirs from the earthquake. So,
oh. Yeah. Huh. Mm. It seems very human.
It does, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like people do that after major traumatic events.
Yeah, I guess that's one way for some people. I don't know if they feel like that's one way to deal with it, or if it's just one way to make money off of it. I think that's probably true. And so it just seems kind of sad, like to mm-hmm. you know, to have sort of a mercenary kind of look at disaster. Just seems kind of like that's not one of our better qualities.
No, it's not. It's not. Yeah. When I say human, yeah, it's the bad part of us.
The probably. Bad part. Yeah. Right.
So, Susan, as an author who writes mainly historical fiction, how do you go about like choosing your subject matter for your book? And what's that process like for you?
Well, I'm always after a story that hasn't been told yet. And so I'm looking for events in history that suggest to me I could tell a story here. I could use this backdrop and tell a story because I always want my books to be about people, not the event.
Right.
It's about people.
And this
first.
Book certainly is about the people. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Yeah. That was important to me that it mm-hmm. didn't, I didn't want it to be, it's not an earthquake
right.
book. It's a book about a person,
mm-hmm.
but you know, she goes through this experience and it changes her and it affects her, impacts her, all of that. And so I have a file going of historical events that interest me. I probably won't write a book on all of them, but I like having this little well of ideas that I can kind of sift through from time to time, you know, just because I know that the past is something we care about. Otherwise, we wouldn't have museums. We wouldn't care. We wouldn't teach history in schools.
Mm-hmm.
So history matters to us. And it matters to us, I think, for a reason. It's because it's our story. You know, it's the story of us. And when we look back at the past, we can see what matters to us, what doesn't matter to us, what we're willing to fight for, what we're willing to protect. And so I think historical events then are like little spotlights on history that kind of remind us who we are. And the best way to be reminded of that event is, I think, through story.
Mm-hmm.
Because a history book will tell you what happened, But a novel will take you there and let you feel it. And I think an experience is a better teacher than just details and data. And so that's why I think historical fiction has a great place in keeping the past alive, because it can take you there.
And there also has to be some time. Like, I don't think, I'm not going to read a story about the insurrection in the Capitol right now, but down the road, right. I'd love to.
Yeah, I think the benefit of time is just that it gives us time to kind of settle. And then it's good to look back. It's good to look in the rear view to see what we've learned from the past and our own mistakes.
Mm-hmm. For sure. I also think it's remarkable. I think you've written 15 books.
It's a little more than that, but that's okay.
Let's count the posters. Can we count the posters behind it? Let's count the posters. How many posters do we have?
Yeah. the older ones aren't in print anymore, and I'm okay with that because I cut my teeth on those books, and they were contemporary. They weren't historical fiction. I switched to historical fiction in 2008, and that's my lane. I've stayed in it, and so we can start with 15. That works for me.
But I feel like you do write historical fiction, but I think we need a new genre, because your book, I consider a novel that just happens to have a little bit of history in it. You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't even consider it. I'm sure they have to slap a label on it to help sell books, but this is just a great novel that just happens to have a little earthquake in there, you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's not, like you said, it's not. It's just a great story about some interesting characters with some twists and turns along the way that I loved. Yeah,
yeah. There's a big mystery thread in this one, which some people have written to me and said, well, this isn't historical fiction. No. This is a mystery, or this is a thriller.
Yeah.
And so in some ways it's a little bit genre bending, and I'm okay with that too, because sometimes a book doesn't just neatly fit into one genre over another. And I'm okay that history lovers, I think, will like it, and people who like a good mystery, I think, will love it. So I'm hopefully not going to. I'm hopefully we'll just gain new readers rather than polarizing the two kinds of readers.
Pleasing readers everywhere. That's what you do.
That sounds nice. I like that tangle.
Yeah,
I like that a lot.
It's almost like historical thriller, I thought.
Oh, yeah.
Page turning.
Such a page turner.
Yeah, I think writing that many books with historical fiction in particular, because you have to do research for it, that's really remarkable. What is your writing regimen like? Do you have a word count per day that you set for yourself?
I do, and I don't start writing until I've done all the research first, as much as I can. You know, sometimes you have to come out of the pool to research something you didn't think you would need to know. But for the most part, I'll spend about 4 or 5 months where that's all I'm doing is researching the topic and everything I think I might need to know. Like if I decide to make my main character an Irish immigrant, well, I need to know where she's from and I need to know how she grew up. And if I'm going to have her be in New York for a time, I need to know why it was so terrible there. And if she's going to be on a ferry crossing the San Francisco Bay, I need to know what it feels like. So all of that I have to know up front, for me anyway, before I start writing, so that I don't have to come up out of writing mode to go back into research mode, because they're a little different. You know, the writing part's very creative, and the research mode is just very different. It's more academic, if you will. And so once I start writing, then it is a word count goal. So I'm happy with 1,500 words a day. I shoot for 2,000. And most days I'm able to meet my mark. There are days where I can write those 2,000 words and be done by lunch, and those are great days. Ooh. And then there are days when I'm still struggling at the end of the day and I've only got 1,000 words. And, you know, I pat myself on the back and say, tomorrow's another day. You know, you gave it your best. And so the next day I try to make up for the loss. I don't always, but I try to make up for the time that I lost the day before. Hmm. And a lot of times I do. And sometimes it's good just to sleep on it, because sometimes after I do, I come back down to the writing room and I open it back up, and what was holding me back yesterday is no longer the case. So sometimes it is just, you just need some time away, just, you know, to sleep on it. Mm-hmm. And then I can get back at it.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy one aspect more than the other, the research versus the writing?
The research part is lots of fun. It really is. And I love all the rabbit trails. And as a writer, there's no guilt with going down a rabbit trail. You know, if you're writing a dissertation, you kind of need to stay on topic. But when you're researching to write a novel, anything goes. I can go down any rabbit trail I want, and it's all for the book. So it doesn't matter. It matters if I don't ever stop researching. Right. I have to set a day where it's okay. Now you're going to start the book because it's fun to research. It's hard to write. And so if I don't set a day to say, no matter where you are in the research process, you are starting, that gets me going. Otherwise, I would always say, oh, I'm not done researching yet. So I usually have to, you know, put a cap on the research, knowing that I'll probably get back to it every now and then as I begin writing. But then I begin the writing then. It's pretty disciplined. It's hard to write. It's great to have written. They're different, you know what I mean? Like, it's hard to do the writing, but it's almost like a hard run. You know, after you run, it's no fun doing the exercise, but when you're done, you feel great. That's how the writing is, too.
Well, as a runner, and I'm getting ready to go for a run here in just a second, I can 100% understand where you're coming from. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Susan, it is time now for our segment we call Quick Six, Six Quick Questions, in which we find out just a little bit more about you. Here we go. What is the last show you watched or binged and really enjoyed?
Oh, the last one was, Umbrella Academy. Oh. We just finished the Umbrella Academy last night. I can't wait for season 3. And it's not going to be out until 2022.
Oh, come on. Get on
it. I know. They kind of left everything, you know, like on a cliffhanger, which is typical. Uh-huh. And so, we're just like, we're probably going to have to watch season 2 over again, because by the time season 3 gets here, we'll have forgotten way too much. But yes, we just finished it last night. It was fun.
That's a fun show. Yeah, that's a lot of fun. So unique.
Yeah, it's very unique.
What fictional world or place would you like to visit?
Fictional. Oh, fictional. That means anywhere.
Yeah.
I would love to go to Narnia in the good years. You know, in the good years.
Too.
Like where all the hobbits are and their curly hair and the ale and the singing and all of that. But I wouldn't want any of the other bad stuff, you know, no Sauron, no goblins, no ring wraiths, none of that. Only the good stuff.
Nice caveat.
I got my worlds mixed up.
Oh,
hobbits and Narnia. Okay. Yeah, which one?
Yeah, I mixed up the two worlds, probably because in my mind they're both wonderful. Mm. I would go to Narnia too. Middle Earth or Narnia, either one.
All right.
Yeah, I'd pick either one too. I was tracking with you on the Narnia though, especially.
Narnia's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is a, how about this? What is a movie you would not skip past while flipping through the channels?
Oh, you know, I'm a sucker for You've Got Mail. Love it. I don't know
why. Right there
I've
with
seen
you.
It probably 100 times. Yep. I could probably speak all the lines myself.
Yeah.
But I just love that movie. I love the cinematography, how they use the seasons to tell the story. You know, it starts in the fall, it ends in the spring, and there's that hard, cold winter in the middle. And just the two characters, it's a great story of two characters, and it's got books in it, it's got a bookstore in it. It's just, it's all my jam.
She's a pill. F-O-X.
That's right. That's right.
We have seen that movie a lot.
Yeah, we've seen it 100 times too, I'm sure. Yeah.
I want Meg Ryan's apartment in that movie.
Yes, right? Everything about it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have a book that's been on your mind this past year?
A book that's been on my mind, like a book that I've read?
Yeah, that you've read that maybe you've just been thinking about through the pandemic.
Oh, you know, it was probably right after the holidays and into January, I read The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue.
Oh, yeah.
And oh, my gosh, that was such an interesting book. And it's the kind of book I really wanted to talk with my book club about, and we're not meeting right now. But the premise is a little bit chilling, so it's not for everybody. But it's about this woman in 18th century France who's desperate to get out of an arranged marriage. And she makes a bargain with a dark deity. Ooh. And boy, does she regret it. She regrets it. But then the story is just, it's masterfully written. Just great characters and the most satisfying ending that I've read in a book in a long time.
That's good. It's on my list. Yeah,
it's a good one.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit creepy. So if a little tiny bit creepy doesn't, if that's not your jam, you might want to skip it, but it's a really good book.
Doesn't bother me at all. Bring on the creep. Yeah.
How about this, Susan? Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
Well, I have a very limited range. I can't sing the high notes. It's like an octave, and that's about it. So if they have The Rose by Bette Midler.
Oh, yeah.
I can sing that. I can sing all the notes in The Rose, but I can hardly sing anything else.
Okay.
That's a beautiful song.
Sure, it is a beautiful song.
You got to love the Divine Miss M, of course.
Yes.
And last but not least, what book are you currently reading?
I just started 2 days ago, Migrations, by her first name, I believe, is Charlotte McConaughey. Mm-hmm. I apologize if I'm not getting her first name right. I know her last name is McConaughey, but it's so far, it's so good. It's about a woman in a world, it's our world, but something's screwed up about it because all the animals are dying. All of the animals are dying. And she's tracking this at Arctic Tern. It's a bird. And she's tracking it on its last migration, which they're thinking is its last migration. But I can tell it's not about birds at all. Mm. It's not even about the fact that all the animals are going extinct. It's really about her and her personal loss. And all of that is like backdrop, like the earthquake. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's so far so good. I'm only 40 pages in, but I'm already swept away.
Oh, that's a beautiful description.
Very
yeah.
nice. Yeah, that is Charlotte. Yeah. Charlotte McConaughey. Matthew's sister.
Thank you.
Matthew's sister. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, Susan, listen, thank you so much for spending some time with us. We loved your book, The Nature of Fragile Things. And speaking of endings, I found your ending to be very satisfying as well. And
that makes me happy. Thank you. I aim to please. Thank you.
Yeah. There she is again. Stop pleasing readers. Come on.
Everywhere.
All right, Susan. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on your show.
Of course.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
The Inside Flap.
Okay, there you go. That was Susan Meisner. Thanks so much to her for hopping on board. All right, let's open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews.
And let's start with
Laura Medicus.
All right, Laura, what book do you have for us this week?
I have Susan Meisner's book, The Nature of Fragile Things.
Such a good
book. So Dave, you and I both read it.
Mm-hmm, great book.
This is a captivating read. It's quick. It's exciting. It reads like a thriller crossed with historical fiction. It's set in 1906 San Francisco, before, during, and after the earthquake, which Susan, when she was talking to us, said it would have been a 7.9 on the Richter scale when it hit in 1906. This book starts with a police interview. You have a young woman being questioned after the earthquake, and the detective wants to know why, 6 weeks after this earthquake, ma'am, why are you just now reporting your husband missing?
Inconceivable!
Yes.
Why are you now coming to us?
Why wait? What's with the wait?
He's been gone for 6 weeks,
lady. 6 weeks? Andrew, how long before Katie goes missing when you report her? How long would you wait?
Now, how long would Katie wait?
I don't know. It depends on the circumstances. It depends on what I think I can get away with.
There you go.
Okay.
So you have that little snippet and you're like, oh, there's something not right here.
Something's not going on.
So then the book flashes back in time. So to before the earthquake, and we meet this wife. Mm-hmm. Her name's Sophie. She's a young Irish woman who's answered an ad in a paper from a man looking for a wife to be a wife and a mother. For his young daughter.
Looking for that male order bride.
That's right. He claims to be a widower who just travels for a living, so he's not home a lot, he says, and he needs somebody at home with his daughter.
Right.
So she travels across the country from New York to San Francisco to meet him. They get married immediately, and he brings her home. Now, right away, there's something just a little bit off about this situation. As a reader, you know there's something hinky going on, right?
Well, you
Dave?
Know something.
There's
is
something odd about this guy.
Right.
The there's something weird
off.
About
you
this
just
guy.
Get your hackles are raised when you're reading about this guy.
He's got a very wealthy home,
and the guy doesn't get upset either. You know, he's kind of
strange.
He's strange. He has a very even keel, which can be a good thing, but sometimes
cold. This seems a little cold.
It can be a little cold. Little,
but he's not mean. So.
Not mean. Not mean.
Yeah, you can't figure out what. So this story gets really moving right away and quickly. And I don't want to give anything away any further because it just starts going with some twists and turns and excitement.
Twists and turns and earthquakes.
Let's just say he is not who he says he is.
No, he is not.
Shocker, right? Yeah. So Susan Meisner knows how to tell a story. She uses the backdrop of the earthquake and San Francisco as a supporting character for her story. It is not the main story. The main story is Sophie and this guy. Mm-hmm. It's called The Nature of Fragile Things. And this book has a cover with a woman who has her back to the viewer. And this is not Susan Meisner's fault. But every historic fiction,
so many,
I'm not making this up, has a woman with her back to the viewer.
Right.
Because Dave and I look at books all the time. We get books sent to us in the mail. And I've yet to see one that doesn't have a woman with her back to the cover. And it's been going on for probably a year.
Oh, it's been going on. Like, I was doing a little
clearly
dive on
it.
It's been going
sells.
On for years, years and years and years.
Why would it sell books, though? Because that's all they put.
Here's
that's like the
from
go-to.
2019 book cover trend watch, World War II era women looking away.
Looking away. It's always a woman looking away. And it's not anymore World War II. It's all eras of women.
Right.
And I guess women read a certain type of historical fiction. We tend to read books that are about women. Men are going to read maybe the more war oriented or about a titan of business or, you know, oriented historic fiction. I don't know what they do for those men, but they do for the women. I can't see the woman's face. I just see her back.
Yeah. Here's an article from 2013. It says, are women's backs the new galoshes on book covers? I don't know. Do book covers used to have galoshes?
They kind of did. Yeah, or they'd have shoes, empty shoes sitting there.
They got a huge collage of books with women in their backs, women's backs. Can't see their faces. Maybe so that's like the reader can put themselves
can project
in the woman's shoes or her galoshes, put herself in her galoshes.
I feel like it's also maybe a backwards looking because it's a historic, so you're looking back. Perhaps?
Reflecting back. It's reflection.
Andrew, it's interesting.
Do you own galoshes, Andrew?
I don't know that I'd call them galoshes, but yes, I probably...
Rubbers,
probably
then they used to call them rubbers, and then they had to stop calling them rubbers.
Oh, they did,
Yeah, I've got one pair. You want to see them?
What? You got them right there? Wow.
Let me just whip it out.
I don't... Easy. Good thing this is an audio podcast.
So you tell me
I see
if
Lex
these qualify...
On the floor there. I do not own a pair. I barely own a pair of winter boots.
You had a pair...
Of galoshes?
My dad gave you a pair of galoshes.
Oh,
what do you think?
And you have a pair in the garage.
Those are like knee high.
Yeah,
those are mud boots.
That's what galoshes
are.
Yeah,
is that what galoshes are? Yeah, galoshes. They're just rubber boots.
They're rubber boots. Actually can wear another shoe usually inside of that shoe.
Well, I own a pair of those. Okay,
you see.
I guess I didn't know what galoshes were.
Oh, that's what did you think they were?
I thought they were rubbers. I don't know.
Oh, that's really funny. Oh, I also have a YA book recommendation.
Oh, yes. What do you got?
It's called The Inheritance Games by Jennifer Lynn Barnes. And it's but most reminded me of a Knives Out type of story.
Oh, yeah. The movie.
If you know the movie. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's really quick. It's a fun read. I read it. I'm an adult. I read a YA book. If you're the kind of adult who every once in a while likes to read a YA, The Inheritance Games is good, and your teenager might like it too.
Every high school teacher, English teacher I know, reads young adult.
Well, it's part of their job too, I would imagine.
No.
Just for fun.
They read it for just for
there's
fun.
A lot of great YA books
and there's
out right
are
now.
A ton of
the YA fantasy. Out. If I was a teenager now, I probably would have I would have no friends because I would be reading YA fantasy.
Caveat.
I'm just
going
to do a caveat.
Okay. All right. Well, The Nature of Fragile Things, in any case, is a great book. And that comes highly recommended from
Laura Medicus.
And me as well. All right. But that is not the book I'm here to talk about right now. I'm here to talk about
Dave Medicus.
Don't Look for Me by Wendy Walker. Don't Look for Me. This is a fast pace. Now, listen, you want something, you want some action, you're tired of, you're bogged down in the pandemic, you want something to sweep you away, and you're looking for a quick down and dirty hitter, this is your go-to right here. This is a fast-paced mystery thriller with gasp-inducing twists that will leave you breathless, almost as breathless as Andrew is after he walked up, had to walk across the room to show me his galoshes. And gasping for air, high stakes, psychological tension that is palpable. So the story is told from two different viewpoints. You've got Molly, and you've got her 20-something-year-old daughter, Nicole. All right. So now Molly, this is a woman who's been suffering from some guilt for quite some time because 5 years ago, one night while coming home from work, Molly's 9-year-old daughter came running out of the house. And at the time, she was being watched by her older sister, Nicole. She comes running out of the house. Molly's driving up to the house, not speeding or anything.
Oh, no.
The girl comes running around and out of the house. And, of course, Molly hits her 9-year-old daughter and kills her.
Oh, my God. Dave, I could not.
So, well, listen, this was in the past. This is 5 years. Now, we flash forward 5 years later. Now, we've got a woman who's got all this guilt, obviously. Her kids hate her. Her husband barely speaks to her. And one night, she finds herself out in a small town, far away from home. She's driving. It's a torrential rainstorm. And she runs out of gas. So walking through this storm, she is distraught. She can't stop thinking about her deceased daughter. She can't stop thinking of herself as this terrible mother. She wants nothing more to do than to walk out of her life and into another life. When all of a sudden, out of the blue, like on demand, what happens? But a car pulls up. And the guy says, "Hey, you need a ride? Do you need a ride? It's miserable out here. It's a torrential downpour. Come on, get in the car." Now, 9 times out of 10, in real life, and it's a driving storm, if a car pulls up to you, what do you do?
If it was the middle of nowhere, I would evaluate the person.
Mm-hmm.
And if I felt like my gut said it's okay.
Now, there's also...
I'd get in.
A young
to
girl.
To be honest.
There's a young girl in this car, too.
Oh, I definitely would get in then. If I saw a young girl in there, yeah, I would definitely get in.
Andrew would not only get in, but he would insist on driving. Well, now...
Maybe safer that way.
Now, here's the thing. Someone forgot to tell this woman that she is a character in a book and is not real life. And no, you should not be getting into any car, even if there's a young girl in there or not. So what happens? She gets in the car.
I mean, I would not blame her for getting in the car.
Well, of course. And you don't blame her.
No.
And, you know, like I said, she's just despondent at this point. She doesn't know what to do with her life. So she gets in this car. Turns out that the guy, well, at first she doesn't realize anything's wrong. The guy's like, "Listen, power's out. Phones are out. Come on back to my house.
Oh.
We'll figure stuff out."
Alarm bells would go off.
Oh, and the gas station. She got to the gas station's closed because of the storm.
Oh.
It's like a hurricane.
That's different.
Hurricane
then. That's different.
Yes.
Okay. I thought he was trying not to take her to the gas station.
Oh, no. Gas station is closed.
Okay.
So takes her back to his house.
Okay.
And he's like, "Well, just spend the night here. In the morning, things will be better." Well, of course, the morning comes and... she starts to putting things together, two and two here, some strange things. This girl's acting strange. The guy's acting strange. She's demanding that he take her out. And then, of course, before you know it, no, he is not there to help her. He has, in fact, kidnapped her. And that's the situation that we are dealing with. Mm. She's trapped in this house on this property. And in fact, at one point, she does get out. It's surrounded by this high fence that not only has barbed wire on top of it, but it's got little barbed wires inside the small little hole.
So he's a predator.
Yes, exactly.
So Dave, hang on a second here.
Oh, I will hang. Yes.
I'm just realizing. So we call it kidnapping. Despite the fact that it's an adult.
Yeah, good question.
Who's been inept. I mean, and it's just kind of strange. I mean, so the term probably originated from a kid being, you know,
napped.
Taken.
Yes, napped. Yes.
But yet, it basically refers to anybody being taken.
Well, and also,
so it's
what
just
about,
kind of a strange.
Yeah, and if we break it down into even further, kidnapping, there's no naps involved unless we're talking chloroform. Unless it's like a chloroform situation. You put that kid... in a chloroform induced sleep, then you've got kidnapping. I don't know. Woman napped just doesn't have the same ring to it. I guess you can say she wasn't kidnapped, and I guess you can say she was taken.
Well, I'm looking, and kidnapping is a legal term, and it's the unlawful transportation of a person against their will. Mm. Doesn't matter what age, but clearly Andrew's right. It must have come. Although, did they call kids? I don't know if they called kids kids back then.
What do you mean if they called kids kids?
I mean...
children?
Children.
Youngins.
Yeah.
I don't know. The point is this. The point is... She can't even have this kind of situation going on because she's taken, which is...
I will look for you.
A Liam Neeson situation.
I will find you.
She's not married to Liam Neeson. And not only that, but her husband and the cops, why they think she has walked out of her life because they find in a motel room, they find a note written in what appears to be her handwriting that says, and let me reference the back to the title for you, "Don't look for me." Basically, they think that she has abandoned her life and abandoned her family. The one person who's holding out hope for her is her 20-something-year-old daughter, Nicole, who is desperately trying to track her down. Of course, when this Nicole, who has problems of her own, when she's not doing vodka shots with the local deputy. This is a book you will be hard pressed, and that's all I want to tell you. But there's a lot more to it than that. There are twists, there are turns, there are frights, there are chills, delights. You will be hard pressed to put this one down once you pick it up. This is action packed. This action just propels the story forward. I really enjoyed this one. It is called "Don't Look for Me," and this is something you can tell people as you're reading this book. Listen, don't look for me. I'm too busy reading. Don't look for me. I'm locking myself in the
closet. I did. I tried to talk to you and you're on the sofa and I
kind of
got snapped at because you were almost done with the book.
I don't. Like, oh my goodness.
Do you remember that?
So exciting.
Like this is a really good book, okay?
I don't remember that.
I was like, all right, settle down, man. Settle down.
But anyway, this is written by Wendy Walker and it is excellent. Check it out. And that is recommended by me.
Dave Medicus.
All right, Andrew.
So I have to say, that's like the second week in a row, or maybe it was like the week before, where Dave had another book where somebody had basically hit their own daughter. Right? And, you remember?
Hit their own... There was another... You're right, I forgot about
that. It was just 2 weeks ago. I mean, are you looking for books where you run over and maim or kill their children?
It seems to be a recurring theme. Yeah, in that book, the girl didn't die, or the child didn't...
No.
Yeah, I forgot what the name of that book was.
She was a dancer.
Savvy listeners can go back and check the inside flap.
Andrew remembers that she was a dancer, too.
She was a dancer. You remember that one, huh?
Yeah. So... my book.
Yes, sir.
Are you ready?
Mm-hmm. Are we ready?
Are we ready?
Yes.
We're ready, Andrew.
Okay. So this book it's called Tribute at the Gates. It is from the Catalyst series, book one, and the author is C.J. Aaron, A-A-R-O-N.
Mm. All right, and real quick, that book was The Opium Prince, and that was a guy driving through the desert who hit a girl running out in the road. But yes, he did kill her. So yes, you're right. There's two books in 2 weeks. That was episode 111. Two books in 3 weeks with a dead girl and somebody who hit them while driving.
Nice, Dave.
Awesome. Good job. Nice. There you go.
Yep. I'm paying attention, see? I'm paying attention.
That's right. It's the audiobook of the week is when you check out. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, we all do, Dave.
Yes.
So this book is a svelte 494 pages.
Hmm.
And, you know, I really like this book, and there's five books in the series, and I have plowed through all four. The fifth book is not yet published, but, you know, this book is a really good book. It is a great series. There's lots of detail in here. So if you're looking for a new series, right, to spend a week on vacation, or maybe you're a slow reader and this will take you a month. But this really is a great series. Likeable characters, tons of detail.
Are you the kind of guy who will email an author and ask them when the fifth one is coming out? Because I see that a lot on Goodreads. Like, when is anxiously waiting for your next one in the series. Do you do that?
I have done it on occasion.
Oh, I see people do that all the time. Yeah.
People love to do that. I would hate that if I was an author.
And I'm still waiting for George R.R. Martin.
Oh, boy, yes. Bang that drum. Bang that drum.
So this book, it starts out with the main character is Ryl, R-Y-L. Mm-hmm. And so there's something called the blood of the ancients. And so the blood of the ancients is, you know, you could be born with this type of blood, and it's not, you know, and it could happen to anybody, right? It just happens. So it doesn't, you know, if your dad, you know, and the thing is, has nothing to do, like, if your dad had it or your mom had it. It's just simply random that you could be born with the blood of the ancients. Mm-hmm. Now, if you are born with the blood of the ancients, then you are very valuable. You are worth literally your weight in gold. Mm. And
alive
so
or dead?
Is there's a testing that occurs. So every child that turns 8 years old has to go to be tested. And if you are found to have the blood of the ancients, then basically you belong to the king. You are now property of the king.
Okay, so you're alive, then they take you alive, not dead.
They take you alive. Okay. And so basically your family can give you up, and if they give you up, they will get, you know, your weight in gold. Hmm. But if your family does not give you up, then they will murder your entire family and simply take you.
Goodness. So well, you basically
might as well,
have to
you
give
might as
up
well
your
take
kid.
The gold in that case, yeah.
Yeah, might as well take the gold.
Right.
Or you can abscond to upstate New York or wherever this book takes place.
Yeah. Well, no. Well, it takes place in a fantasy world.
Ah, these fantasy worlds. Okay.
Yeah. And so anyways, so Ryl, basically the book opens and it's describing how he's been betrayed by his dad.
I keep wanting to call him Lil Ryl, like Lil Rel Howery. Lil Ryl. Did you ever call him Lil Ryl as you were reading it?
I did not call him Lil Ryl.
Lil Ryl.
I gotcha.
Lil Ryl.
Yeah. And so Ryl basically is betrayed by his parents. And so what happens to them then is then they become what's called tributes.
Oh.
And the tributes are then put into, they are then taken. They're put in a wagon. You know, they're bound. They're gagged. Right, they have no rights anymore. Huh. They are not free. They are prisoners, and they get put into a type of a, I guess you could call it like sort of like a retainment camp.
Okay,
where they are now slaves. They are slave labor in this camp, and this camp is huge. Right, I mean this camp is, you know, probably hundreds of square miles, but it is completely surrounded by an impenetrable wall. So that these tributes cannot get out. And, you know, maybe there's 500 tributes at any one time living in this huge camp. And so Ryl gets taken. He basically gets put in there, and they've got these huge gates. The only way to get in and out is there's these huge King Kong-sized gates, and that's how you get in and out. And so for the tributes, they go in. And the only time they go out is when – and so what happens is they get auctioned off and sold. When they're captured, they get auctioned off and sold. And then they have to stay in this camp until their blood matures, right? And so that's what they're doing is
– waiting for the blood to mature.
They're waiting for the blood to mature. And, you know, it could be that it takes several years for the blood to mature. And for some people, it might take – you know, 20 or 30 years for the blood to mature. So every tribute has a different amount of time that they're going to spend in this camp.
Yeah.
And so you go in, and the only time you leave is when you are harvested. It's called harvest. And you have burned into your neck your harvest number. And Ryl's harvest number is H1351. And that is burned into every tribute's neck, right, to clearly identify them. And so, you know, there really is kind of the, I guess you would say, sort of the connotation of sort of like a concentration type camp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it is a slave camp, and there is no hope, right? I mean, the people that go in, there is no hope for freedom.
Well, what happens when their blood matures?
Well, and that's something I won't say because it's a bit of a mystery. Like in this book, at least the first book, it's a bit of a mystery, is what happens, right? I mean, is it a death sentence? You know, exactly what happens. And so I will tell you, the reason their blood is so valuable is the blood of the ancients is used to create a elixir which will let people live indefinitely.
That's really valuable, then.
Wow, that is valuable.
Yeah,
and so they are essentially the fountain of youth. And the royalty and the people that are extremely wealthy, this lets them, you know, live for hundreds of years, if not longer. Right? And that is...
What an interesting
concept. That is why the blood is so valuable. And so there is a camaraderie in the camp. The tributes, you know, and Ril is a... He is a great kid.
No, Ril.
He's making the best of the situation. But, you know, the tributes, they are a great family. They help each other out. They're in this hostile environment where they are abused. As long as they don't kill them, they are basically abused within an inch of their lives. Slave labor, right? I mean, essentially they have to farm and do all kinds of things. And so, you know, but they still take care of each other. And they try to find joy when they can. But there is always the impending date. Each person has got a expiration date on them, or a maturity date, where they know they're going to have to leave. Right? They're going to have to leave the camp, and they're going to have to leave their friends and their family, because they really are a family. The tributes, right? They become a family. And so, what happens with Ril is the book takes a turn.
No, Ril.
And I should mention that Big Ril's is different. So of course we've seen this before, but Big Ril's blood is different than everybody else's blood.
Mm-hmm. We have seen this. Right? Oh, so
where does this sound familiar?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So his magic is different. Mm. His blood is different, and he has active. His blood is active where everybody else's is not active. And so this opens up some doors for him. And so what happens is Ril is heading from one part of the camp to the other. And he gets caught out in a violent thunderstorm.
Oh, it is like my book.
And so there's no way he can make it.
Oh my God, Dave!
Being caught. What's that, Laura?
I played a thunder sound effect.
And so he is caught out past curfew. And so there's some guards, and if you caught out past curfew, he knows that he's going to get beaten, maybe maimed. Right? He's going to get beaten within an inch of his life, and so. What happens is he runs towards the woods, and, you know, he doesn't know it at the time, but these woods, everybody's afraid of the woods, but the woods are alive, and they're called the Erlin Woods, and they are actually alive, and the woods open up a path, and they let Ril basically escape from the guards that are trying to capture him, and so he has a moment of refuge in the forest, in the Erlin Woods, and so, of course, he meets somebody there, and the person he meets there basically lets him know that, you know, hey, by the way, there is a prophecy, and we have been waiting more than a millennium for a tribute to show up with active blood. And this is where things start to change. So Ril spends a day in the woods, and then he basically has to hightail it to make it to his work assignment, and things start to change. And so, you know, you go from this where you care about the characters, you care about the tributes, you care about Ril, but they're living in a place where there's no hope. Nobody has any hope. But then Ril has this experience, and what changes is all of a sudden, just like that, because Ril is alive, because Ril is. Has the active blood, and because Ril is the catalyst that will start things changing. But what he brings most of all is he brings hope to the tributes, hope that something is going to be different, and hope that something is going to change. And so I read right through the first four books. I'm going to have to email that author and let him know.
Yes, you do.
When's that fifth book coming out?
Get on him.
Don't pull a George R. R. Martin. Publish that damn thing this century. So the book is Tribute at the Gates. It is book one of the Catalyst series by C.J. Aaron.
All right, very good.
And don't you think, though, that George R. R. Martin is rolling in money?
Yeah, he doesn't.
And there's
care.
No reason to finish
he's
it.
He's got no motivating.
That would be my guess. And he's older.
At this point, clearly.
And he could buy an island somewhere and just live the rest of his days. Yeah. That would be my guess.
Well, let me just say, what if J.K. Rowling was stuck on book two of Harry Potter? I mean, come on.
Oh, you know what, Andrew? That's a very good point.
Yeah.
She is still writing, and she is writing under a detective, the Cormorant Strike novels, which I really like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good point.
All right, Andrew, that sounds like a good book. I have to pretend to check that one out. No, I'm actually kidding. All right, that means it is time. One question, though. What do you got these? So you say it was -5 degrees. Now, as you know, I'm somewhat of a connoisseur of having spent all my time in the virtual classroom this semester. Somewhat of a connoisseur of ceiling fans. Now, I see you've got your ceiling fan going.
Oh, you are a connoisseur of ceiling fans.
Yes, I've seen a lot. It looks like you've got the X472 going. Looks like you got it on medium speed. Now, why, with the temperature that low, are you running a ceiling fan?
Because I've got the fireplace on, and the ceiling fan helps to distribute the air in the room.
Get that heat around there, Dave.
Okay. You got it sucking the air up then?
Did you reverse it?
I don't know what direction it's going, but you know, but up, down, does it really matter? I mean, the thing is...
It does.
Going up, yeah, it's circulating the air in the room, right? I mean, either it's being pulled up,
and
it's coming out by the walls.
Well, you've got it reversed, so it's sucking it up instead of blowing it. Okay, all right.
As long as it's moving, it's circulating the air. Seriously.
All right.
Tell you what, you know, you're starting to be as picky as that woman at the dental office. For God's sake, you want to take my temperature now?
Listen, I'm just saying.
Yeah, I had my temperature taken 3 times.
I know a thing or two about ceiling fans now, so I feel like I gotta.
Is it a 3-blade fan or a 4-blade?
Looks like a 4-blade fan.
Or it could be 5.
Looks like a 5-speed optimal.
Is it a light kit on that fan, Dave?
There is a light kit on it. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Get a life, Dave. Get a life.
All right. I have a life, and you know what I enjoy doing with my life? I enjoy listening to audiobooks, so that's why I bring you one every week. And man, oh man.
Audiobook of the week.
Have I a good one for you this week. My audiobook this week is called Lola on Fire. This is a novel by Rio Ewers, narrated by Jim Meskimen. And oh my goodness, this book is so, so good. This is an action. This goes hand in hand with my book, my Wendy Welker book this week. Don't Look for Me. This is an action-packed, lots of action, a fast-paced thriller that delivers on the goods. It's a cat-and-mouse affair between a gangster, the woman who turned on him, and a brother and sister team caught in the crossfire. So the gangster in question is the notorious mobster Jimmy Lazzo, a known bad guy who shows no mercy. And in fact, one of his favorite things to do is to whip out the old flamethrower on his foes from time to time. And in fact, it is this flamethrower that gives the book its title, as Lola in the opening scene is under siege from Jimmy's flamethrower in, oh my, just an incredibly exciting action set piece that kicks the book off immediately. I was hooked into Lola on Fire. If you're going to read a book called Lola on Fire, you better put Lola on fire. You know what I'm saying?
Oh.
And they do. But
it reminds me of Run Lola Run, the movie.
Yes, exactly. And I was thinking of that too a lot because it's fast paced.
Well, and there's a woman called
there's
Lola.
There's a woman named Lola. So Lola naturally gets the best of Jimmy, but instead of killing him off, you know, these people in these books, you get the chance to kill the bad guy, you kill the bad guy. No, instead what she does, she puts a slug in his guts and wants to inflict a little pain on him and leaves him there. So, of course, she wanted him to suffer, and of course, he doesn't die. You just don't leave Jimmy Lazzo alive if you've betrayed him, because he will spend the rest of his years of his remaining existence on Earth trying to hunt you down.
Yeah, you got to watch him die.
This is exactly what happens. Right. So we smash cut to 26 years later after this just electric opening scene. And Jimmy Latso still alive, of course. Now he's always been on the lookout for Lola, who is in hiding somewhere. But of course, Jimmy is always watching. Meanwhile, we meet the down on his luck Brody. Now, here's a guy, Brody. He's desperate to get a little cash. He wants to help his sister out. His sister needs money for medication. So what he decides to do, I mean, what are you going to do? You want to go rob a place? It's maybe the guy watched a little too much Raising Arizona. He saw Nicolas Cage robbing the convenience stores. So,
you know, the only thing I remember from Raising Arizona is Nicolas Cage's hair in that.
Yeah,
isn't that weird? Great hair. I don't remember anything much else about the movie.
The chase scenes? Him going through, getting the Huggies, Pampers, the diapers?
No.
Mm-hmm. I need to watch just that one again. That's just a great movie.
Well, you know, the one scene where they're out on the road, like in the middle of nowhere, that's actually Cave Creek, Arizona.
Oh, really?
Now, of course, that's where I was married, was at the Four Seasons in Cave Creek, Arizona.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's cool. Yeah.
Oh, and that's where they filmed it. Oh, very good.
Yep.
Well, nobody was shooting at Pampers Diapers or Nicolas Cage at your wedding, luckily. So anyway, Brody decides he's going to rob this convenience store. And he actually goes through with it. He is able to successfully rob the store. Well, later on, he realizes that his mistake, and this is a little heads up for all you junior criminals out there. If you're going to rob a convenience store, don't leave your wallet at the scene of the crime, as he has left his wallet at the convenience store. And the next day, he gets a phone call from a girl or young lady who has found his wallet. And in fact, she was coming in as he was running out, so she had witnessed him trying to rob the convenience store. Now she blackmails him into robbing her house. And here's a guy, poor Brody. I mean, this is a guy who's just down on his luck. He just wanted to get some money to scrape together a few shekels to help his sister out who needs medication. And now it's like he's this career criminal, and she wants him, this girl, to rob her house to get her mother's like Harry Winston jewelry for her.
Wow.
So now he's in it. Now it's either that or she's going to turn him over to the cops, right? So now he's in it. He reluctantly agrees, but when he breaks into her house, all is not as it seems. He finds himself into deep, deep trouble. And from there, man, this book really takes off. This is seriously exciting stuff. This is a cat and mouse game that is a nonstop thrill ride. Let's take a listen to a clip. This is Lola on Hiya!
At the height of his influence and infamy, Jimmy Latso had 26 people on his payroll. They ranged from personal assistants, lawyers, and crooked cops to soldiers and enforcers. When a situation needed attention, Jimmy liked to go in strong, and he only hired the best, the most accurate shooters, the smartest negotiators, the deadliest fighters. Lola Bear ticked every box, and a few boxes that Jimmy hadn't considered. She joined his ranks in 1991. It was highly irregular, hell, totally unheard of, for a woman to be on the front line, Renee said, adjusting her position in the wheelchair.
All right, there you go. That is your magic audiobook of the week, Lola on Fire. Check it out. That is read to you.
Magic audiobook of the week.
Jim Meskimen, written by Rio Ewers. Yes. I don't know why I said magic audiobook. Yeah, magic audiobook.
Sure.
All the audiobooks that are brought to you on this particular podcast, which is
The Inside Flap,
which shall henceforth be referred to as magic audiobooks.
Oh, I'm reading a good fantasy book that I'm going to bring for next week. Really excited about it.
Okay, very good.
Yeah. Speaking of magic.
Speaking of magic. All right. That's our show for us this week. Thanks so much for listening. My name is Dave Medicus. We'll see you next time.
Adios.
The time you enjoy wasting is not wasted time. Bertrand Russell.
I like that one. Send them all in.